Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the Political Party Podcast. This episode features founder partner of Britain Thinks, Deborah Mattinson. And this is one of the most fascinating discussions I have ever had. Deborah is basically an oracle for everything that is going on with public opinion at the moment. And building on the fascinating Mood of the Nation research, which is available for free to read on the Britain Thinks website, as well as a rich resource of so much other previous research they've done. Which, if you're interested in this sort of thing, and if you listen to this podcast, I'm guessing you are, go on there and just enjoy it. It's incredible the insights that are available on there and the knowledge you will glean about public opinion and attitudes towards all sorts of things. And of course, this is all in the context of Brexit and the leadership of the two major parties and everything else. It is just, it's so rare you can talk to somebody who gives you such clear answers about what people think and about the things that are happening in our lives, the undercurrents of British society. And we barely scratched the surface, really. There's so many other things. You're basically talking to someone who can tell you exactly what the country thinks. And, I mean, that is rare and thrilling. So I can't thank Deborah enough for coming in and sharing with us her expertise and the great story of her life of working for the Labour Party. And I won't tread on that because she tells us about her career prior to setting up Britain Thinks. And of course, we talk about what Britain Thinks may do next, which is also very exciting. Deborah is author of a fantastic book called Talking to a Brick Wall. We touch on it slightly, but it's still available to buy. And there is a link in the show notes to this on the device that you're listening to this on, where you can buy that book should you wish. So, oh yes, and of course, I'm in the Edinburgh Festival in a few weeks with my brand new show, Brexit Pursued by a Bear. Yes, I'm running out of Brexit puns, but you can get tickets for that show through the Ed Fringe website, edfringe.com, and just search for my name. I'm doing two political parties up there, one of which the guest will be Nicola Sturgeon. The other guest I'll be announcing very, very soon. So lots going on, but for now I will leave you in the wonderful hands of Deborah Mattinson. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Deborah, you're the second pollster that I've had on here. We had Lord Cooper on a few months ago, particularly talking about his role in the referendum campaign and polling more widely.
Yes.
And like him, you share an illustrious background in working in politics. You were Gordon Brown's pollster for many years.
I was.
So before we come on to the work of Britain Thinks, just in terms of being Gordon Brown's pollster, was that purely during the time that he was Prime Minister, or were you working with him when he was Chancellor?
So I worked, I worked with Labour for long before. I worked for Labour in the dark years before 1997. The first election campaign that I worked on was 87.
Oh, my God.
So I'd been working in advertising, and I'd offered my services to my local MP, Alf Dubs.
Oh, wow.
And he then, who's great.
Yes.
This was in Battersea. And he then said, oh, there's this group of people who are advising the party on its communications. And he knew I worked in advertising and suggested that I went along, which I did. And it was full of people who are like the age I am now. I was then a lot younger. And I figured that I couldn't sit and offer the kind of eminence grease that they were offering. I was also the only woman in the room, which became a very familiar story.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I can do stuff, though, actually. I can get things done. Because they just all talked, but I could say, hey, well, let me take that and turn it into a leaflet, or let me... And I accessed the team, the creative team in the ad agency I was working for, and started just doing things. And the Labour Party had just hired a new comms director, bright young thing called Peter Mandelson. Another person who was on this group was Philip Gould.
Wow.
And Peter took Philip and I out for dinner one evening and said, look, we've got an election coming and I need you guys around all the time. And so I gave up my job.
And was that... So in terms of
so
moving...
So this is 86.
So in terms of moving from the red flag to the rose...
Yes.
Was that something you were...
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yep.
I mean, one of the, in terms of British politics, one of the most significant rebrands, really, and that's pre-New Labour.
Yep. I mean, I talk in my book about the first focus groups that I went to. I didn't do them. Like Philip, I started off on a different side of, you know, of the kind of campaign team. But sitting in on focus groups and hearing people talk about the Labour Party and... You know, it was just so obvious that there was so much work to do.
Yeah.
so, yeah, it took us 10 years.
And here we are again.
It might take more than 10 years this time. Who knows?
Maybe. So just in terms of coming from advertising into politics, I mean, people are suspicious of advertising now. Labour then, I imagine, elements would have been highly suspicious of you.
So when I joined the Labour Party, which I did the day after the 83 election... yes, thinking, oh dear. Yes, exactly. Really. When I joined, I went along to my local Labour Party, which was Battersea, and they asked me which union I was a member of. I mean, I worked in an ad agency. I joined a union because you had to be a member of a union. And this rep came along from the union to sort of, you know, brief me and ask me if I needed any support. And I didn't feel I did. So that was fine. But yeah, I mean, it was another world.
And in terms of, just in terms of going into advertising, what was it attracted you to advertising? Was it the kind of creative element of it?
Yeah, I think so. It was fun. I was interested in communications. I mean, I barely knew advertising existed. I'd actually initially started looking at things like PR. I'd done a law degree, actually, and I knew I didn't want to do law. That's the one main thing I'd learned from doing a law degree, was that I didn't want to be a lawyer. So I kind of stumbled across advertising and then thought, hey, this is fun. It's quite nice. People get to wear their jeans to work. It's great.
Was there any part of you that thought, before joining the Labour Party in 83, that thought, actually, this at some point this might be quite helpful if you're a politically aware person? I might at some point be able to... use this for a political purpose?
I mean, I would love to say there was a kind of master plan and it would, no, not at all. I mean, I just did the next thing that came along. Then I ended up. I mean, at some point, having worked in advertising for a while, I was beginning to feel I'm running out of steam with, you know, looking at brands of shampoo and I worked on Kentucky Fried Chicken at one point.
Great.
Yeah, it was great, actually. It was really great. But you know, I felt that I would like to do something kind of more meaty and interesting and worthwhile.
And that's what got you involved in the Labour.
Yeah. And that's why I started sort of like volunteering. And...
So you've got Mandelson, Gould, you're in the room. Who else is around? Who was the guy? And I always...
Patricia Hewitt was another
Pat
really
Hewitt,
key
Hewitt, of course,
figure.
Yes, with Excalibur.
Yeah, the only other woman in the room. So she and I are still good friends.
So there was Tessa. Who was...
Tessa wasn't even an MP at that point. I think she won her seat in 87, or did she win in 83? I can't remember. But I didn't meet Tessa for some years, actually.
And then I'm just thinking, students of Labour history are going to damn me for... And I'm damning myself for not being able to recall his name. Brian, who's the guy who went to Australia?
Brian Gould.
Yes,
of course.
Brian Gould, of course,
yeah.
So he was there.
So he was running the campaign in 87.
Wow.
So our sort of 8 o'clock in the morning strategy meetings were run by him. And he was just amazing.
So you were immediate into the heart of it then. So you were, I mean, fascinating, just, you know, one of the undercurrents from Labour then to now, particularly in the New Labour era, was Peter Mandelson's relationship with Gordon Brown. So you'd have seen it at the start when they were still mates.
Yes.
And then
yes.
seen it, you know, erode
when
and then
they stopped
see it
being
rebuild.
Mates and then seeing them become mates again.
Man.
Yeah.
So you've been there for that a long, you know.
Yeah. And those differences then, I mean, boy, is that the vanity of small differences,
yes.
You know, I mean, you know, I ended up working for Gordon. Philip ended up working for Tony. And we were sort of on opposite sides of the fence. When I look at the differences between us now, it's just extraordinary.
So during that period then when you... And there were, I mean, yes, there were. I mean, particularly in retrospect, the differences are so small. But there were cultural differences, personality differences, as well as ideological, relatively small ideological differences. Did you ever fall into the kind of trap of tribalism in that period, do you think?
in the sense of being
a brown knight.
I mean, to be honest, I started working for Gordon. So I worked for Labour. Although, in fact, when I say I worked for Labour, I always did other things as well. And I think that was quite important, actually. I always kind of kept one foot in the camp of the real world. So I, after the 92 elections, set up the first company that I set up called Opinion Leader Research and ran that. And I carried on working with other clients and as well as working for Labour. In the run-up to 97, I did a lot of, by then I was doing focus groups and doing qualitative research mainly. I did a lot of the work that tested the pledges, for example, that went on the pledge card.
Fast track punishment for young offenders. Now here's
our little test. Can we remember them all? No, don't ask me. I probably can't.
Okay, so it was class sizes under 30.
Yes, class sizes under 30. Yes.
Fast track punishment for persistent young offenders.
Hospital waiting lists.
There was no income tax rise.
Yes.
And there must have been a crime one.
Crime.
Cut crime, really.
Yeah.
Well, there you
and
go.
What was extraordinary was that, you know, okay, we're struggling to remember it some years on, but actually in that election campaign doing focus groups, by week two, I would say to people, how different would it be? What would happen if Labour got in? And people literally just could trot them off.
So the messages were cutting through.
It was so clear. It was so clear. It was just extraordinary.
I've still got a little batch of them.
Have you?
97 pledge cards,
in the
loft in a cupboard somewhere.
Yeah.
I got a load from when I worked on the Sedgefield by-election after Tony Blair left and Phil Wilson was the candidate. Yeah. Just in the back room at Trimden Labour Club, there was just all this, as every Labour Club has.
So you just took it all for,
for your... Yeah, obviously admitting to theft. They let me have it. I mean, they've got so much stuff. I just took a kind of little wadge of 97 pledge cards. Yeah. So they're still there. I mean, focus groups became a phrase that the public knew in that New Labour era. And it was used in an almost pejorative way, you know, that policy had been focus grouped in the sense that it gave the impression it wasn't coming from a place of conviction that you would ask the public first and then develop policy. Yeah. I mean, is there any truth, do you think, that there was a negative side to it? In terms of, rather than coming from a place of conviction, Labour was just letting the public tell them what they wanted to hear and then putting that message back to the public.
I have literally never worked with a politician who has said, go and do a focus group and find out what we ought to be saying.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't think so. And I always regard, you know, this is a way, I think it's an important part of democracy. This is a way of having the voter in the room.
Yeah.
It really matters. It's really important. And I felt it was an incredibly important thing to do. And all politicians think that they're in touch with their electorate. All politicians think they know what voters want because, you know, they chat to their mates and they chat to the people that turn up to their constituencies. They chat to their local members. And actually, they have no idea how ordinary people's lives are. And so for those politicians, it's a way of understanding what people think about you and what they say about you when you're not in the room as well.
Do you think it would be a good idea for just constituency MPs to run them? And not run them themselves, but have them run in their constituency just to find out?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I mean, they have to be well run. And that there is a caveat there because they're small groups. And just like a poll, you know, it matters. They can be twisted and affected. How you run it can make a difference to the outcome that you get. So they have to be well run. And crucially, the people that you get have to be people that are properly recruited into the process and you have to be really confident that they're genuinely representative of the audience that you want to have reflected in the discussion. So I think they do have to be well done. But yes, why not? I think it would be a really good thing to do.
You mentioned something there that goes to the heart of so many of the issues at the moment, particularly with political broadcasting, which is how do you rigorously find a fair, balanced sample of, say, 100 British people? So when... You know, you have leadership debates or whatever and people watch Question Time and go, well, this is just full of Corbyn supporters, rightly or wrongly. How hard is it from your point of view, if the BBC were to come to you and say, look, we need a balanced audience of 100 people? You know, my view was always that, well, some of them are going to be lying to get in. Or can you easily override that?
I have done that work, and Britain Thinks has done that kind of audience work a little bit for broadcast organisations. It's very tricky and it's harder now because you have to really check people's credentials very clearly. You have to look at their social media accounts. You have to really know what they're doing. And I think one of the keys is perhaps not to say to people, come in and, you know, look at, you know, come in and be part of this session with the new prime minister or whatever, because that's automatically going to attract people in who have a particular axe to grind or have a reason for wanting to be there. Yeah. So the best thing to do, I think, is to initially be a little bit oblique about what they're actually doing and get your people and screen them and be really clear that you've got a good representative bunch.
That's a great idea.
You have to do it that way, because if you don't, you know, if you just ran an ad saying, yeah, interest in politics, come along, and then every nutter in town would be
exactly,
in there.
Yeah.
You know, so, and of course that's what happens, because there are some people who are very highly motivated. Most normal people don't think about politics very much. And in fact, there was a time when we were recruiting people into political focus groups where we stopped saying that it was to do with politics at all, partly because it meant that we were getting weird people who were very overly, people like you or me, people who were very interested in
really
politics.
Weird, yeah.
Really weird. And partly because some people would say, I'm not into politics. You know, I've got a friend who's, you know, and actually we wanted to know what they thought, despite the fact that they considered themselves to be not knowledgeable or into politics.
And at what stage did you start doing that? Like, in terms of how long ago?
What, doing political focus groups?
In terms of trying to get people that weren't political and in terms of hiding the political element of it at the start?
Oh, I mean, quite early on, it became apparent that we had to do that. And that you know, if you wanted to get people who were genuinely a cross-section of ordinary voters, then, you know, kind of trumpeting that you were doing this for a political party or doing it, you know, that it was going to be about... We would say, come along and we're going to talk about issues that affect your local area.
Yes.
Or something like that. And then they would come along. Women in particular were very resistant to coming along and talking about politics.
And would that still be true now, do you think?
I think it's less true now. Because, you know, we're talking about some decades ago now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, back then, literally, we've had recruiters going out trying to find people to come to focus groups, and women would say, you know, actually, if you want to talk about politics, you'd be better off talking to my husband.
That's so sad. I mean, you know, obviously this represents a societal attitude at the time, and hopefully that has changed. When you say recruiters going out, are they literally the people we see in the street with clipboards?
Sometimes, yes. I mean, sometimes there'll be people who are doing polling.
Yeah.
You know, numbers work. But yes, that's how a lot of focus groups are recruited as well. And a company like mine will have a network of people all around the country. So almost wherever you want to do them, I can find somebody who will be able to find people.
And are there,
to fit the bill.
Whenever you're putting a focus group together, as well as thinking about whether this person is a Leaver, Remainer, left wing, right wing, you know, likely to vote, unlikely to vote, depending on whatever research you're doing, do you also have to have different personality types at different times? Like, do you think actually you meet someone and they're going to be too dominant in the room and you think actually that's not going to work? Or do you think actually a dominant voice would be good to kind of provoke other people, or is that not?
Well, that's where the skill of the person who's moderating the focus group comes in. So, I mean, you know, this cat sometimes is tested to within an inch of its life, I can tell you. But basically, you know, a good focus group moderator can iron those things out and will say, you know, actually, Matt, I think we've heard enough from you now. I've got a very clear sense of where you're at. You know, if we can just let Daisy here come in or whatever. And that's how it would work.
Get a lot of emails saying that, actually. You've really hit upon something a lot of listeners have said.
A raw nerve. But no, it's... I mean, you know, there are lots of different devices that you can do that will nicely put... you know, kind of shut people up, basically, and enable... And things you can do to enable quieter people to have the confidence to put their view out. Like, you get them to do little things, exercises in pairs, and then share it back. Or there are lots and lots of different things you can do.
And would you ever deliberately seek out... So, for instance, shy is an interesting word, given the so-called shy Tory phenomenon. Would you ever try and deliberately have a focus group of shy people to find out how you kind of make them less shy, or is that not... part of it?
No, you might. I mean, actually, more often what we do, we quite often recommend to clients doing work with a group that we call social influencers. So it's the opposite of what you're saying, where you have a whole room full of loudmouths.
Oh my God.
A whole room full of people. It's the kind of person who, you know, in the playground, you think, I want to know what's going on with the new head. You know, who's the person to ask? Or okay. At the workplace, who's the person to find out? You know, we know who those people are in yes. our lives. They're relatively easy to recruit and they're very useful people to tap into sometimes.
Okay, so sometimes there is a deliberate
choice.
Yeah,
so you might
of...
go for a particular personality yeah. type and you certainly might go for particular voting patterns. Or other kinds of behaviour patterns, yeah.
In terms of your antenna, and you must have such a... I just imagine that you know almost what everyone's thinking at every one point. But you must have such a sharp antenna for where the public mood is because you've seen so many yeah. people talk about it across the UK, about every issue, and you're constantly collecting this data. Do you ever sit in a focus group and think, actually, I think this isn't where the rest of the public are?
Yes.
Or this is a kind of freak. This is an outlier.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, when you design a piece of work, you have to think carefully about how many sessions you're going to do, where you're going to do them, how you're going to run them. And, yeah, occasionally you will get, like you get a rogue poll, you will get, it's even more likely if you think about it, because it's a small number of people, you might get a group of people who, for whatever reason, are atypical.
And then, I suppose...
And you have to know enough to be able to aim off and... Yeah. I mean, particularly with political work, because I've just done so much of it, I can read it quite quickly. Does this feel right or does it not feel right?
And do you ever get a sense then, you know, you're obviously exposed to so much data, qualitative and quantitative, as well as everything else that you're taking in. Mm. Did you see any of the shocks coming over the past 4 or 5 years?
Oh, I'd love to say yes. So, OK, I saw Brexit coming.
Oh, man.
That was, so I took to, I spoke at lots of things through that referendum campaign, and I took to asking the audience, stick your hand up if you think that Remain is going to win, and everybody would put their hand up.
Oh.
And actually looking along the panel, even the people who were there representing the Leave campaign would have their hand up. Everybody thought, and I would say, there is no evidence to support that view. And people say the polls were wrong, they actually weren't wrong. Some polling was wrong, but yeah. the polls weren't wrong. If you look at the poll of polls, actually overall through the campaign, more polls predicted Leave than Remain.
Yeah.
And basically all the way through, pretty much once it got going, they were within the margin of error too close to
yeah.
call. It was entirely predictable what happened. And if you were out there doing focus groups and listening to people, it was really clear that it literally could go either way.
And I suppose one of the things, and I talked about this with Lord Cooper, was about likelihood to vote. So mm-hmm. some people were then adjusting the polling, say, actually, once you factor in, you know, these people have never voted before,
yeah.
and then actually, once you factor that in, Remain comes ahead, that people didn't see that.
Yeah.
This was energising yeah. people who'd never
yeah.
voted.
And that's always the challenge, is turnout. Is,
yeah.
You know, and it's a challenge if you're looking at a general election campaign as well, and how you plan for that. And how you work that through. Yeah, of course.
In terms of then this, I mean, the, you know, the length of your career and the level at which you've, you know, worked in the industry as one of the industry leaders for so long and worked closely with leading politicians. When you think about the societal changes that have happened in your career and the changes in public opinion, what's your assessment of where we're at now? Is this just a kind of... are we going through a series of peaks and troughs that we see throughout history, or are we living in something different now?
I have literally never known British people be as gloomy as they are now. Britain thinks we've just done a piece of work called The Mood of the Nation, which is the second time we've done
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I've got a lot of questions about that.
Yeah, and it, you know, they are very, 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 very gloomy. And there's a sort of inequality of pessimism as well. So certain sorts of people are even more gloomy than others. So young people are massively more gloomy than older people. Working class people are more gloomy than middle class people. People who live in cities are more gloomy. There are some really... And I think, you know, this is partly... Brexit has shone a light on this. Because I think the other thing that I haven't seen in my career is people having such a negative view of politicians as they do now. Now, you know, it has always been the case that people have doubted sometimes, have doubted the motivations of politicians,
yes.
right? Bluntly, they probably thought they had their fingers in the till.
Yes.
That's always been the case. But what they think now is that they're looking at politicians with a fresh pair of eyes and seeing levels of incompetence that they find very, very scary.
And is that just Brexit that's done that, or is that on the back of expenses, Iraq, you know, the other kind of fence posts in that relationship?
I think it's Brexit that's done that.
Yeah.
And if I compare it with how the mood was after the expenses scandal, I don't think people felt very differently. It confirmed what they thought they already knew, rather than change their minds. Whereas now, I think their minds are changed.
And is it that the expenses confirmed what they thought about corruption, and that's a different analysis, and actually Brexit is about competence and ability to do the job?
I wouldn't say that expenses was really about corruption. It's about it was more what people felt they knew. I mean, obviously, there are a small number of MPs who were corrupt and probably still are. There probably still are a small number of MPs. Mm. But I don't think most people thought that their politicians were actually corrupt. It's a sort of just a low-level mistrust of their motivations.
Yes.
That they're in it for the wrong reasons. That they're not in it to make the world a better place. But they are in it to feather their own nests in one way or another. And that was what was confirmed, I think, by the expenses scandal. What we're seeing now is a feeling that they are out of control, that even when they want to do something, they have no idea how to make it happen.
And is that shared by Leavers and Remainers?
Yes, yes. Because when you look at the Brexit process, frankly, whichever side of that fence you sit, you're not happy.
Yes, yes, very true. Just to come back to something you said about young people being gloomy. Historically, I always think of young people would be more optimistic.
Yes.
So is that something that's changed? Or actually, does polling say young people are always a bit more gloomy, but it's the extent of that that's changed now?
Well, I haven't actually got trend data on this, so we haven't asked the question quite in that way. But I think it is a change, and I think it's partly because it partly comes back to Remain, Leave. By the way, Remainers are also more gloomy than Leavers, actually. So everybody's fed up with the process. Nobody thinks it's working. But Remainers definitely think whatever the outcome, ultimately, it's not going to be one that's good for them. And, of course, that correlates with being young. So younger people are more likely to be Remainers.
Yes. So you mentioned the Mood of the Nation report, which is fascinating.
Yes.
Reading and available for free on your website.
It's available for free, as is actually, just if you're interested in Brexit, our Brexit Diaries series is fantastically good and is also on the website.
Your website is a rich resource of fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I put one of my favourite pieces of work you ever did was after the 2015 election, the kind of snapshot of the British public. And I love the quotes that you got from the different, you know, parts of the UK. And I never forget, I think it was, there was a really funny, I ended up doing a stand-up routine about a really funny thing that someone in a Scottish focus group had said, which was basically that, I think in one of the Scottish focus groups, everyone had blamed Gordon Brown for something apart from them, basically. There was a kind of a slight cognitive dissonance about why things, I can't remember the exact phrase.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm annoyed with myself that it's deserted me. But the point really being, the broader point is, you put a lot of this stuff out there for free that people can access on your website, and it is it's a wide and deep river of information about the British public and why they think certain things. So, just in terms of the Mood of the Nation 2019 thing, you ran four focus groups, two in London and two in Leicester.
Yes,
I kind of understand why you picked London.
Yes,
why Leicester?
So actually, Leicester, because that part of the Midlands is one of the most gloomy and negative bits of Britain. So we were quite interested to sort of, to sort of listen to people who were coming from a gloomier perspective and people who were coming from a more positive perspective in London. In fact, it turned out not quite to be like that. So there were some very interesting things in London that people feel gloomy about. I mean, I'm hearing things in focus groups now that I haven't heard people complain about since the 1990s.
What,
right? Like, this is partly austerity driven, so cuts to schools, hospitals, crime. Now, crime is extraordinary. And what we found with this survey was that one in five people think that they or a close family member may well be a victim of violent crime in the next year.
Wow.
And that rises to one in three in London. So I hadn't heard people talk about crime for a long time.
Yeah.
Homelessness, again, was something that just sort of disappeared off the agenda. You know, people weren't seeing it as a kind of blight on the public realm as they do now, as a scar, you know, on our streets.
It's so visible in every town and city in the UK, in every part of London now.
Yeah.
And in, you know, wherever I go, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Nottingham, it's everywhere. It's incredible how visible it's been.
But basically doing focus groups, you know, in the run-up towards the 97 election, which I mean the years running up to that, I would hear this stuff again and again and again. And then a lot of it slipped away and I'm hearing it again now. But the difference is this, that at that point when I was hearing it before, Labour's lead over the Tories was actually bigger than Labour's total poll score now. So
wow.
Labour's polling less than 20%.
Yeah, 18% I think on the last YouGov poll.
Yeah.
I mean, as someone who served the Labour Party for so long, how does that make you feel, seeing the predicament Labour in now?
Oh, it's desperate. It's desperate. And actually, I think it's unforgivable because, I mean, it begs so many questions. Would we even be in this position? I think everybody raises their game if you have a decent opposition. Then the government, you get a better government. That's the point of opposition. That's what you're there for.
I mean, if Jeremy Corbyn said to you, Deborah, I hear you, you know, I heard you on the Political Party podcast, please come into the heart of my operation and help us out. Would you help him or...
I don't think so.
No. And he might not.
By the way, funnily enough, I think he's not going to ask anyway, so we don't need to torment ourselves too much, sort of gaming out that one.
So it's fascinating just looking at the four focus groups you ran and the way that you broke it down.
Yeah.
So the two you ran in Leicester, the first one was aged 50 to 75,
yep.
Working class, voted Leave and pessimistic. And the other one was aged 35 to 49, working class, voted Remain and was pessimistic. And then the two in London was 40 to 65, middle class, voted Leave and optimistic, and 18 to 34, middle class, voted Remain and optimistic. So you've tried to sort of shuffle it.
Yes, so we were trying to reflect what the polling was telling us about where the pockets of pessimism and optimism were with those geographical locations. I'd say it wasn't in the end that simple, but... You know, we weren't doing very many focus groups. We had to find a way of structuring it that kind of made sense to us. So that's what we did.
And what are the, I mean, obviously, it feels quite negative so far. What are the things that give people optimism in Britain at the moment?
Well, what's quite interesting is actually people in their own lives feel more positive. So, you know, the negativity is when you think about the nation. When you look at, you know, the country and what lies ahead for the country is where people are, they're most gloomy. Then when you think about your local area, I perk up a little bit. I'm still quite gloomy.
Yeah.
And then when I think about my own life, you know, whilst obviously people are grappling with issues in their lives like they always have done, nonetheless, people do feel more positive. And I think another quite interesting finding from that work was that people kept saying to us, you know, in the end, we're British. And although there is a feeling that our, you know, that we're a country in decline quite severely, that British values are slipping and not what they were and so on. Nonetheless, people would say, you know, in the end, we'll get on with it. Whatever happens, we'll get on with it. Well, there's a great quote that's in that deck, actually, that you've got there, that where somebody said, you know, the thing is, when the French are upset, they go out and riot on the streets. But we're like, let's go to Tesco's and get some beers.
I mean, I'm sure we can all agree on that. Just in terms of British values, do you get a sense that people agree on what British values are?
Yeah, in the poll, we took the definition of British values that came out of the focus groups. And what people talked about was fairness, exemplified by something like the NHS, good manners, tolerance. So they had a whole list of things that they felt, and we used that definition in the poll.
And they're things that Leavers and Remainers would both agree on.
Yes.
They would both identify.
Yes.
So actually, there is a set of British values that you could probably write down.
Yes, there is. Yes.
Because sometimes it feels like quite a nebulous thing that people are, you know, some people's British values might not be the same as others. But actually, it's fascinating that.
Well,
people
of course, these are quite
divide.
Broad as
yes.
well. So then when you actually, well, what does that actually mean? Then, you know, then the devil is in the detail.
Yeah, bring
bit.
Back hanging and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe not, but yes. So, you know, there are, and the one thing people can agree on is how divided we are as a nation at the moment. And they're really upset about that. And they're really, you know, they want to see us brought together. I mean, that's the political challenge in a way.
Well, it's good that people actively want that, I suppose.
They actively want it. They really want it.
Want that healing and want that unity. Just in terms of when you talk about people being more optimistic about their own lives. Is it that they're optimistic in the sense that they're in loving relationships and
yes.
they love their children?
My family and, I have a nice holiday and
yes.
whatever. Yes,
but that's distinct from perhaps their own futures in the sense of job security and things like
that? Well, I think it does relate to that. And I think that's one of the reasons, if we're to think about why it is that young people are more negative and pessimistic than older people, they feel less of a sense of job security. They're more likely to be working on 0 hours contracts, to feel that they don't have a positive future ahead of them. Housing is an issue for them. They're more likely to be, feeling that they can't afford to buy a home, that they'll never get to buy a home, they'll never get a foot on the housing ladder. There are lots of very specifics then that play out in people's lives and colour their view of the whole country.
And when you look at this stuff, particularly this Mood of the Nation report, with your political head on, what does it tell you about what the policy solutions are to the nation's troubles? Brexit aside, it sounds like homelessness, the housing crisis. I mean, these are all things that are kind of being discussed anyway, but it sounds like those things are the kind of, and crime is the top.
So, this is quite interesting. When you ask people in focus groups, why are you so fed up with politicians now? I think there are a number of things that come out. One is there is a sense that everybody is playing party politics rather than putting the national interest at the heart of what they do. So that's one thing. Another is this sense of incompetence. So even if they mean well, they're not somehow able to deliver. And then the third is, I suppose, a bucket that you could broadly call opportunity cost. So everybody is faffing around with Brexit, and then there are all these really important things that matter to me that aren't getting dealt with. And that's, funding for schools and hospitals and homelessness and housing and, you name it, crime. And that's what starts to make people really angry. So the policy, that's quite clear, I think.
Yes.
How you achieve it is something else, and that's where leadership comes in.
in terms of where the British public opinion is on the classic political issues, so things like tax and spend, do you get any sense that people are more likely or less likely now to say, I'm happy to have an increase in my personal level of taxation if it would improve the NHS?
I think taking that particular example, I think yes, actually. One of the things that I worked on for Gordon when he was Chancellor...
Well, I saw I was going to come on to the National Insurance.
Yeah, the most popular tax rise ever in the history of tax rises. And there have been lots of them. And that was, putting the funding, putting NI up, specifically ring-fenced to fund the NHS. Now, it's easy to look back on that and think, well, that was a bit of a no-brainer, wasn't it? But at the time, after years of Tory government, frankly, in a lot of people's minds, the jury was out about whether the NHS was even worth saving, whether it was so run down that it would be better to think again. So one thing we had to do was to persuade people that the NHS was worth saving. And then, we embarked on this quite long programme about how to make the case for this tax rise. And it took a long time, but eventually we got there. And it worked, and it was, and I think there are ways of doing that, but it slightly depends how much trust you place in the person who is levying the tax on you. And this was where, so I did a piece of work, I think it's what you were referring to earlier, after the Ed Miliband election.
Yes.
Where, it was really clear that the principal reason why Ed lost was because people didn't trust him to run the economy.
Yeah. There was that. Also, the kind of, the SNP message, the picture of him in Alex Salmond's pocket.
Yes.
In retrospect, that seems to have played a part. At the time, I didn't necessarily think that was going to cut through in the way that perhaps it did in certain areas. Did you pick up that was a big issue for voters, particularly in England?
Yes. I actually think, though, the piece of work that we did in hindsight, to kind of what went wrong piece of work, definitely highlighted people's concerns about spend more than anything else. But there was also a sense that they didn't know really who Labour was for, or at least with ordinary voters, whoever Labour was for, it wasn't for them.
Yeah.
We did, one of the things we do a lot in focus groups is something we call a mood board. You put lots and lots of photographs and you say, so which of these people would be people who would benefit if there was a Tory government and a Labour government? And when we asked the question of a Tory government, these ordinary voters picked out people a little bit like them and said, I think they'd probably thrive. And when we asked about a Labour government, they really struggled. And in the end, they picked out the people who look really kind of like down and out and poor and needy.
I remember that from the research that they said it's not the Labour Party, it's the Benefits Party.
Yeah.
The people perceived it wasn't even for the working class.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is a huge problem. Yeah. I mean, Labour's obviously yeah. got a whole load of different yeah. problems
which
there.
Which is a massive feeling of deja vu because, you know, when I first started working for Labour back in the day, that was exactly where we started.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Just in terms of, and when you do these bits of research, the bits that catch the headlines and they're always so funny is when people associate politicians with an animal.
Yeah.
Or, you know, words you would associate with a politician. Yeah. Now,
they or obviously... party brands. That's my favourite is actually, you know, what would be the come dine with me celebrity meal for the Labour Party?
Oh,
and
that's
wow. I've asked for years. So it used to be like a pie and a pint back yeah. in, you know, back in the kind of, you know, 80s.
Yeah.
In the Ed Miliband era, it morphed into something slightly different. So this wasn't a sausage roll. It was sausage en croûte. And it wasn't like an ordinary pint. It was craft ale, you know, from a microbrewery in Primrose Hill.
Wow.
Similar. And then with Jeremy, it's gone like one step further. And, you know, the meal for Labour now is quinoa.
And what would
And those... I discovered nobody knows how to spell it, including me.
Oh, no, quinoa or what
yeah,
is
exactly,
the way I was trying to
exactly.
remember. So what would they say for the other parties then? What would the Tory meal be?
Well, that's what's quite interesting, because the party brand of the Tories has really hardly changed at all. It's the poshest thing you
Champagne
can think
and
of.
Champagne caviar.
Yeah. Whatever is the poshest thing you can think of. Quail.
And what about the Lib Dems? Tofu? And is it stuff like that?
Well, you know, I haven't done this for the Lib Dems for quite a long time because, you know, they haven't really been players. They wouldn't have had enough of an image.
Oh, God.
I know. But I think we might have to start doing that
now. An empty plate, yeah.
I think that I think once they have... I mean, actually, one of the things we're planning to do this summer is a piece... which is a tracking piece. I've done it a number of times, looking at what leadership means. So, you know, when we have a new Tory leader, when we have a new Lib Dem leader, and we have Jeremy, I'm going to look at what kind of leadership they offer and what people think
Great.
Of them.
Because with the meal question, with the animal question, are they things that you think, actually, this is a really good way to get this research in the public realm? Because, you know, papers will pick up on that. And does it just serve that purpose? Or is there a wider purpose to that?
It literally isn't done for that reason, but I mean, it's fine if that happens. But the reason why we do it is these are called projective techniques. And you were saying earlier about, you know, how you get people to talk and and if you have people who aren't very interested in politics and often haven't articulated their thoughts very clearly, it can be quite hard. And what they'll do is give you a very rational answer. But actually, a lot of this is really emotional, heartfelt stuff. Mm. And so the reason for doing the animal piece or the you know, the food or the drink or whatever, the car. I mean, Theresa May was a Reliant Robin.
Oh,
you know,
no.
Three-wheeler. You were just amazed that she kept going. So
it really works as an analogy.
It so
though.
Works. And the reason why you do that is if you asked people just to give their rational thoughts on Theresa May, they'd come up with something that wasn't true.
Yes.
It's a way of getting to a truth and helping people to articulate what they actually feel when they're often not used to talking about it.
So what car do people say Corbyn is?
I haven't asked a car of Corbyn for quite a long time, and I suspect it will have changed. That will be one of the projects over this summer, yeah. will be to really look at the leaders and how they're seen. But basically, you know, the vote has been on a bit of a journey with him. They started off, whether they would have voted for him or not, kind of admiring him. Mm. And yet, as things have unfolded, they now Actually, they judge him more harshly than they judge Theresa May. 7 out of 10 say that he is putting party interests and his own career ahead of national interest on Brexit, for example.
That's more than would say it for Theresa.
Yeah, it was 58% for her.
Okay. That's fascinating, given that he's in opposition as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose, in a way, he wouldn't be a car. Because he'd be...
Maybe he'd be a bike.
He'd be a bike.
He probably would. Yeah.
There's a great quote from one of your focus group members in the Leicester group that I've heard so many... I grew up in Nottingham, so maybe this is something that only affects people in the East Midlands. But I hear this a lot when people talk about other countries' perception of the UK. And this person in the 50 to 70 group in Leicester says, I think we can't do it as a country. It's a world thing. We're not a polluting... So they're talking about the environment. I should make that clear.
Yes, yes.
The US, China and Brazil, they're just laughing at us.
Because we are, this little country, and we're not, whatever we do won't make a difference. And yet, at the same time, one of the things that we did with the Brexit Diaries was to ask people to draw maps of the world and place Britain in the world. That's on the website as well, and it's fascinating. I think it's the one before last, so probably March, Brexit Diaries. And, I mean, basically, first off, people draw the UK huge, much bigger than it actually is.
Oh, no.
Then it's about what they don't put onto. So Africa never features. Interestingly, Ireland rarely features. So, so much for the backstop and all of that.
Well, they don't physically draw it on a map.
Yeah, we say draw a map of the world. And that's what... they draw a big lump in the middle.
Yeah.
Right in the middle. And that's Britain. And then there's a big lump next to it on one side, and it's the US. And a big lump on the other side, and it's Russia. And then, if you're lucky, you might get like France and Germany.
I mean, Italy's easy because it looks like a boot.
I know.
But oh my, this is...
And the scale thing is really... Have a look at them on the website because it's very interesting. And it tells you so much about where people are coming from when you think about foreign policy.
Wow. I mean, that idea that they're laughing at us, and I don't mean it in the sense of because of Brexit we've made fool out of ourselves, but I always heard it from more nationalist people. There was a bloke who used to drink in my local pub who'd always say, they're all laughing at us, mate. They're all telling jokes about us. And I used to say to him, Rog, I don't think they are. I really don't think people in Nigeria are sat around making jokes about the English. I just don't. And this sort of perception. And I wonder if that is just something that's resonated with me because I've heard it in, places before.
I must just say, actually, I was presenting the Mood of the Nation work in Brussels, right, to a Brussels audience on Monday. And when I got to the slide where they say, we're a laughing stock in Europe, they're laughing in France and Germany, I looked up at the audience and they were all sort of sitting there, sort of quietly shaking with laughter.
I guess what I'm trying to get to is there a part in, not so much the leave mentality, although it would be more there, but in the kind of more nationalist element of the British psychology that thinks the rest of the world is kind of, and historically has thought that somehow we're a laughing stock? Or does that not come through?
I think that they think that we're not, the rest of the world doesn't pay us the dues that we deserve. I think they think that in different ways. And that's partly where you get this thing about feeling that Britain is a country in decline, and people sort of harking back to the kind of good old days when Britain was great and so on. And that will, if I was to sort of stereotype the kind of person that would hold that view, they will tend to be older, probably a Leave voter, possibly a Conservative, certainly small C Conservative in many of their views anyway.
And when you ask them, or do you ask them about what it was in the olden days that they think we've lost, they think we're in decline, what was it that made us great? What sort of things do they say?
So people talk about the empire.
People
talk
common is
about
that?
Us being sort of thought leaders in the world. I mean, that's my expression rather than one they would use, but I think that they do think that.
Do you think people appreciate what the empire was, or do they just think, oh, we used to rule the world?
Yes, they think that. Yeah. Rule Britannia.
It's not necessarily that we were literally enslaving people and that's what they liked.
Yeah.
It's just the sense that we were in charge. Yeah.
And that's where, the antagonism towards the EU is not new news. I mean, that has been there forever. I mean, the first work that I did looking at attitudes towards Europe was back in the 80s. And it was disastrous, people. And the thing that was interesting was that back then, and same now, people really struggle to list the benefits that they got out of being part of Europe, but they could list all the downsides, all the silly stuff, the sort of straight bananas and the rules and regulations and so on, and they knew all of that. And, you know, that writing has been on the wall for a long time.
I suppose what's changed now, in terms of, for Remainers who want a bit of hope, there is a more of an organised pro-European argument and movement now, probably for the first time, certainly in my life. So that might change things, if there were to be another referendum on the deal or whatever.
Yeah, the really interesting thing, what we've done with the Brexit Diaries, is to sort of track views in the 2.5 years since Article 50 was triggered. And really the most striking thing is how little they've changed. I mean, very broadly, this is broad, there's a little bit of movement, but it's a third, a third, a third. So you have a third of people are the group that we call the diehards, who are, you know, very gung-ho about leaving and can't see anything wrong with it. About a third are the people that we call the devastated pessimists. The little icon we use is a person with their head on their desk. And, you know, they are utterly distraught, can't see any benefits to leaving. And then there are two, if you like, swing voter groups in the middle, and they're about another third. So we're very polarised in those views.
There's a great stat in this latest Mood of the Nation that society is split between haves and have-nots.
Yes.
And it splits 52-48. Mm. And I just wonder within that, so people can self-identify as a have or a have-not.
Yeah, yeah.
What, I mean, do you think, when you see this, are there people that identify as have-nots that you would think, actually, you probably are a have, and likewise the other way around? And what is the mindset of people that identify as one and not the other?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think, I mean, the surprise for me was how many people, I think it's quite a strong piece of wording to call yourself a have-not.
Yes.
And yet, you know, that many people do.
48%.
And the reason why we asked that question in the poll was because that was a term that people kept using, the haves and the have-nots, in the focus group. So we thought it'd just be very interesting to get a number on it. And it was quite striking. And then again, there's a sort of inequality. There are certain groups of people who are much more likely to define as have-nots and who feel on the edge much more than others.
And who are they?
So they are the working class people. They're people living in the north and the Midlands rather than the south.
Yeah.
They're people living in not living in urban in you know kind of urban conurbations. They are younger, again. So you know there's a whole mix of attributes that mean that you're more likely to self-define.
And do people broadly self-define themselves correctly? Do you think?
I think it's very difficult because, in a way, does it matter? I mean, what I always say to clients who say, well, hang on, they're wrong, though, aren't they? Well, no, that's what they think, and perception is their reality. So let's work with that, because that's what they think, and they think it very clearly. So I don't know.
And it's obviously 52-48 is a delicious irony that it cuts
like
that.
It works beautifully, doesn't it?
And you know, are the majority of the haves leavers and the majority of the have-nots remainers, or how did that sort of cut down?
From memory, I think it's actually the other way round. I think that leavers were slightly more likely to be have-nots than remainers, who were slightly more likely to be haves.
And I suppose that resonates in terms of people feeling disaffected and wanting change.
Yeah.
the elderly are more likely to think that Britain is in decline. I suppose that's not too surprising.
Yeah, but that's the one thing. You know, across the piece, they're more optimistic than their younger counterparts. That's the one thing that they're more gloomy about, is kind of looking back at this, you know, glorious nation that we used to be and thinking, oh, I wish it was like that again.
And when people say that sort of stuff, and obviously we know, you know, it's the empire and things like that, do you ever kind of try and challenge them and say, but actually, you know, certain things have got better? Do you ever try and sort of provoke them in that way?
Yeah, so one of the things that we do, and there are lots of different techniques that we use, focus groups, polls, is a deliberative methodology where, so an ordinary opinion poll tells you what people think given how little they know, but if you do something like a citizen's jury, you can introduce evidence to people and you can see from that what are the things that might encourage them to change their view or look at something again. Or, you know, if you understand this trade-off or that trade-off, do you still think that policy is a good idea? And, you know, I'm a big fan of this as a way of doing all sorts of kind of decision-making, particularly policy-making. And I think there are things that you can do that are very, very effective in terms of, you know, and really take people with you in your thinking and help them to kind of, you know, become policymakers themselves, I suppose.
Because you would say to people, well, what about life expectancy? Or, you know, I suppose in the last 10 years, wages have stagnated. Yep. But broadly, compared to the 1950s, people live longer, they're healthier, they're, you know, paid more and things like that. When, I suppose challenged is the wrong word, but when presented with those sorts of arguments, do people change their mind or do they dig in?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to fight with stats. So I remember doing a piece of work looking at attitudes towards immigration and giving people a lot of stats. And typically, if you hear somebody sort of arguing about immigration, they will band it. You know, they'll throw stats around. What we found was that people come in with a particular view, and it's a very emotional view. Mm. It's not rational at all. And
on both sides.
On both sides of the argument. And, you know, the more that you try to counter their emotional belief with your statistic, the more they challenge the statistic. And they'll say, you know, well, they would say that, or where did that come from? Well, they would say, you know, the government would say that, wouldn't they? That's what, you know, what all the time. And they will challenge your fact with their belief, and the belief will always win.
So the way to win, so for instance, if you wanted to convince the British public that immigration was a good thing,
yeah,
and obviously you have to facts that underpin it, but actually it would be to talk to people with an emotional argument rather than a stat-based one.
Yeah, I think so. And also, I mean, the thing we always say when we're doing kind of communications testing work for clients, be they political or anybody else, is start your argument with where your audience is, not where you wish they were.
Yes.
Because if you start your argument with where you're hoping they're going to get to, they're just not even going to listen. They're just switching right off. But if you start with something they can nod to, then you've got them listening, and there's just a chance that they might actually listen to the rest of your argument.
There's one of the slides in the Mood of the Nation thing says there's a sense that the British public is resilient and able to just get on with things despite, yes, the national gloom and negativity. Is that about just in their own lives, or do you think, because the way that Brexit is discussed, and maybe this is a part of our national characteristic anyway, that people just think, well, if we all just have to pull together and work harder, we'll have to do it. Do people think in a way they can kind of affect Brexit in some way?
I think they certainly think they can make the best of a bad job, whatever it is, whether it's Brexit or anything else, that way. And that was quite striking. I mean, again, we asked that question in the poll because it kept coming through the focus groups. And it wasn't just the kind of, you know, the leavers and the people who were more positive disposed towards Brexit who felt that. It was everybody. And I think you can see, I think it was 68% from memory, agreed with that.
Yeah, 69%.
69%.
So close.
So close. It's within a margin of error. It's fine. So, you know, people felt that quite strongly. And we just get on with it. That's what we do. We're Brits.
And how much, if at all, did difference in what sort of Brexit people would like come out? You know, are people who voted Leave split on a no-deal Brexit? Or do most of them say, well, if that's the way we leave, we leave? Or do some of them say, actually, I didn't think it was going to be a no-deal. This is
where it gets very tricky, because people tell us that the more they hear about Brexit on the news and so forth, the less they understand and the more confused they get.
Wow.
And they feel that there is this kind of cacophony, there's the vocabulary, the words that they, you know, you could put a gun to their head and say, explain to me what a customs union is, or I'm going to shoot you. And you just have to shoot them because they wouldn't know.
To shoot them. That is the conclusion of this report. We all need shooting.
They just wouldn't know.
Yeah.
And then the less they know, the more they switch off, because, you know, news coverage tends to go straight to those points and we'll reference them and we'll assume that people know what they're talking about. And it becomes really problematic. So people just don't have a very sophisticated or nuanced view. Do people, I mean, qualitatively and in the polling, actually, what we find is that, just as you'd expect, you've got people quite polarised, a third, a third, a third. People are drawn to extremes. So you've got about a third of people who, frankly, think that we shouldn't be leaving at all, and about a third who think we should just get on with it and go whatever, and if that's no deal, so be it.
And then it's the third in the middle then, and that's where, you know, that's where the politicians listening and those that can affect things, and people
swing,
like yourself.
The swing voters.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what is it, do you think, that would win? You know, I know I have a lot of leavers listening to this, so forgive me for indulging my own politics for a second, but from a Remain point of view, if there was to be a referendum to break this deadlock, what are the messages and what are the sort of vehicles of those messages that would convince the people in that middle third to basically stop Brexit and vote to Remain?
So, I mean, I think...
I realise that's a big question.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that where the Remain camp went wrong last time was relying too much on, you know, elites, experts, powers that be, whatever that is. I mean, I remember talking to somebody senior in that campaign and saying, I don't feel it's going very well. Our focus groups are not good and I'll come and share them with you. Yeah. And he said to me, wait till next week. It's all going to be okay after next week. So I watched with great anticipation. And when I saw what happened next week, I knew this was the event that he had was referring to and he thought was going to be the massive game changer. It was Barack Obama.
Oh, dear. Back of the queue.
And I remember doing focus groups that week and people saying, he comes over here, he tells us what to do. It was just a disaster.
Yeah. It annoyed me.
Yeah.
And I voted Remain. Yeah. I thought it was awful.
Yeah.
It was such a bad idea.
Such a bad idea. And I think all the way through there was this, you know, there was this assumption. It was a bit about Project Fear and maybe there was nowhere else to go. I mean, I know a lot of people feel that actually in the end, having people fear the consequences of leaving was probably the best thing that you could do in communications terms. And I think that may well be true. But yeah, it was handled badly.
And also, I suppose, what I, in a way, not that it's my role to defend them or otherwise, but I suppose what they might say in their own defence is a lot of those warnings are turning out to be true. And you can't not warn people, you know, particularly if it was government policy effectively to stay in the EU. You can't have a prime minister who doesn't let the public know what the risks are. I suppose it's about how you balance that as a part of a wider campaign.
Exactly.
So next time it has to be less top down, I suppose. It has to be a bit more...
And I think it has to show more much more clearly what this means. But, it, you know, next time, will there be a next time? I don't know.
But do you think, I mean, maybe, OK, I'll put some scenarios to you and just see whether you think they're good or bad ideas. In a referendum campaign, if there is another one, would it be a good idea to make a kind of explicitly pro-European case, to kind of pitch Britain as a European nation and appeal to people to feel European, or would that be a very bad idea?
Do you know what? I think back a lot to this very first piece of work that I did looking at attitudes towards Europe back in the 80s. Now, I think if somebody had set out then and started building the case for being this proud European nation and talking about the benefits, we might be in a very different place now. But, you know, people take a long time. Attitudes are long held. It's not going to change in the space of a short, you know, campaign. No.
Don't pitch it as too pro-European. What about pitching it as in a kind of patriotic British, wrapping themselves in the Union Jack? Would that be a better way?
That would be a better way of doing it, and then showing how our relationship with Europe is, you know, enhances that. That might be a better way of doing it.
In terms of the elites and the establishment perception, how much, if there is another referendum, will that have flipped if you have, you know, Prime Minister Johnson delivering a leave that he campaigned for? Is there a perception thing that actually some people might say, well, actually, they're the elite now. They're in charge, they're delivering it, and actually the people who are pro-European or Remainers, we're the outsiders. We're not the establishment anymore. Is there any chance of that kind of cutting through?
I really don't know. I think it's going to be... I mean, let's assume it is Boris. We'll know soon enough.
Yeah.
I think it really is going to be fascinating to see what he does, because I think he does have an opportunity, obviously. And for all I've just said about how gloomy people are and how fed up they are with all politicians and so on, you know, every time people vote, it is this triumph of hope over experience. And you vote with hope in your heart and you want it to be different. And he has that opportunity to say, here I am, I'm a different leader and I'm offering you something very different. So that, you know, maybe that can work for him. But what I would also observe is that, you know, somebody who's sort of looked at views of Boris for a long time, you know, going back to before he was mayor of London.
Yeah.
back in the day, in his heyday, he was a sort of Heineken politician who could reach out to the bits that others could get. He sort of almost transcended politics. Mm. I remember doing an exercise where I was looking at a particular policy message and saying, who should be the messenger for this? And they said, not a politician. I then got people to make up little ads themselves saying, what should the line be? Who should be? And they'd all put pictures of Boris on their ad as the person that should be the messenger. And I said, but I thought you said it shouldn't be a politician. They're like, oh, no, Boris is different.
Oh,
now,
wow.
They don't feel that now.
And is that because he's
that
alienated
changed,
48%
yeah,
of the
and he's
public.
Become a very, very divisive figure. Yeah.
But I suppose, in a way, does he possess any potential to regain that, or is that gone?
I think he does, as I say. I think that there will be an opportunity for a fresh start. And sort of, when I was working with Gordon and we were looking to him transitioning from being Chancellor to being PM, we did a lot of analysis of how voting changed with a new Prime Minister, particularly a transitional Prime Minister, i.e. Yeah. one that hadn't been voted in. And it was always the case that 3 months in was as good as it got.
Yeah. So these first
so
3 months...
So there's this opportunity.
Yes.
And if you don't take that opportunity, you've had it. Because then people see you. But in that first 3 months, you know, they imbue you with all the things they want, potentially.
Wow. So, you may well then be... We may get an early election then if he's, you know, if he's...
Oh, I'm very sure that we'll have an early election.
This year?
I think it quite likely because, I mean, apart from anything else, he's definitely going to want to fight Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes. I mean, the only thing I would say is that Tory MPs are desperate not to have one, but I think that's because of where they are in the polling now.
Yeah.
If they get a surge, it will become irresistible,
I
suppose.
If he is able to pull off Brexit in some way, then you have to assume at that point the Brexit Party, is no longer the force that it is right now, because that's all it is there to talk about. Maybe
yes.
He sends Farage off to become ambassador to the US.
But he
gets
may
him
well.
Out of the way.
But you're right. The problem the Tories have had is that the Brexiteers have not thought Theresa May to be a Brexiteer, and to some, you know, that she voted Remain. So
yeah.
I can see.
And in that
point.
Sense, maybe he's got more leeway actually
yes.
as somebody who is clearly a leaver.
And what he can do is suck up the Brexit Party. So he can stop the hemorrhage to the Brexit Party. Maybe get those people back, but. Can he reach out to centre, middle England, not middle England, the centre ground of the UK?
Well, that depends on what he does.
And just in terms of, the not just the Blairite view, but I suppose the kind of the Labour view has always been, particularly the Brownite Blairite group and Kinnock as well, that when you have a traditional right-wing party against a traditional left-wing party, a traditional right-wing party wins. Is that the case now? Do you think Boris against Corbyn, as awful a choice as so many people will find it, necessarily delivers a Johnson victory or not?
I don't think it's absolutely clear-cut, but if I was putting money on it now, I think that's where I'd put it, yes. I mean, if you look at the Labour Party really should be polling in a much, much stronger way than it is. And even then, it wouldn't mean that it would necessarily win.
Just in terms of your own career, obviously this amazing career, published author, talking to a brick wall. People, I will put the link so that people can buy it.
Excellent.
in the notes. So I'm sure many people will. I've advised prime ministers and done polling at the highest level. Was there any ever part of you that thought, actually, I'd like to go into politics myself?
No, never.
Not at any. Not even in 1997.
Not ever.
Why
no.
not?
Because I think I sort of. I saw my role as being this link between people, voters, ordinary people, and politicians. And that's what I enjoyed doing.
But that would be dynamite. I mean, you understand the public more than any other politician, probably. That was, you've got power in your hands.
I have, yeah.
And people can get access to that power for the right fee.
I just was never drawn to it at all.
And was that just because of personal sacrifice you'd have to make, or just the way politics is unattractive?
I think it was a bit of both, but I think I just felt that there was a real kind of mission doing what I'm doing.
So in terms of the future now for you and Britain Thinks,
yeah.
I mean, you've got such an the client list on you, McDonald's, Oxfam, the Nationals, and basically everyone at some point has used you.
Yeah.
That's not going to change. Are there any things that you would like to do differently in the future? There's certain things where you think, actually, in 5 years, I'd like Britain Thinks to be in a particular position? Or?
Well, I think, so one of the things that I think is really fascinating is is not just a British perspective, but a sort of more of a global perspective. Yeah. And in particular, I'm very interested in what's happening here compared to what's happening in Europe, what's happening in the US. I want to do, for instance, this Mood of the Nation type project in other countries and sort of be able to contrast it. In particular, I'm interested to understand, you know, Trump's America compared with Brexit Britain. And I think that's something. So, you know, we called the business Britain Thinks, although something like a third of the work that we do is international. We use the brand World Thinks, which sounds very global. but yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a sort of ambition, is to be doing more international work.
You know, the work
so
you could do with the Democrats, for instance, would be, you know, change the course of history if you would help them defeat Donald Trump. I mean, there's a part of you that thinks, actually, we can get out to America before the 2020 election. And
yeah, I think, I mean, I think that, I mean, I don't know about actually doing work with politicians there, but certainly I'm very interested to understand the American mindset.
Oh, man, well, what an exciting prospect for the next few years. Deborah, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here today and picking your amazing brain about not just political and polling history, but where we are as a nation.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure, really enjoyed it.
Cheers. Well, there we go. Deborah Mattinson from Britain Thinks. And in the notes, you can see how you can follow her on Twitter and follow Britain Thinks on Twitter and buy her book and just follow their work, because it is amazing, fascinating stuff. Particularly when, at the moment, you're just trying to second guess what everyone thinks and why, and what are the, not just on whether we should leave or remain or deal or no deal, but just the undercurrents to British public opinion and how far some of these things go back. And all of that is available for free on their website. And it is, it's just so pleased that Deborah is doing this work to enlighten us all about where the public are. I've always been fascinated by polling and about why people have opinions and how do you change them? Can you change them? What changes them? And things like that, as I'm sure many of you will also identify with that as an area that perhaps you wish you'd worked in. And I always think, I'd have loved to have worked for Ipsos Mori or for Britain Thinks or something like that. So it's just great to pick the brains of an expert. And that is one of the great thrills of doing this podcast. So thanks to Deborah. Thanks to you for listening to it. I'm, as I said at the start, currently writing a new show for Edinburgh, which you'll be able to buy tickets to, Brexit Pursued by a Bear. The tickets are available through edfringe.com. And as always, you can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. So many great guest suggestions that have come out of that. So hopefully those of you that emailed in will see the guests that you requested in the coming weeks and months. And if you can, please leave a review on iTunes or whatever your podcast provider is. It really does help. It seems like such a small thing, but it really does help other people find it. And if you could just spread the word about it, I'd be very grateful. But for now, I'll see you soon. Thanks to Deborah. Thanks to you. Ta-ra. Oh, this episode was produced by Daisy Knight.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.